Okay, any questions? I must be extremely lucid. Do you understand everything? So there are a bunch of things in terms of the announcements. The project one has been assigned. How many of you have read the project one assignment? Okay, that's a reasonable sign, not great sign, but reasonable sign. Everybody must have looked at it. It's a long description, but as I say in the mail, it's mostly to make your life simple, believe it or not. It actually gives you most of the code and asks you to add some extra things for children generator function, etc. And very specific code extension. But then one other thing that you want to understand regarding projects in this class in general is the day your code starts working is not the day you are done. That's the day you start getting interesting phase. Okay, so from the day your code starts working is when you start to play with the code. The whole point of writing programs is to actually play with them. So in particular, in the search algorithms, you want to try out how the heuristics are working. You want to try out how the how easy or hard the problem is to solve. Okay, I don't know. I mean, oftentimes it happens to me in 471 that people have come to 471. Up until then, everything they ever did with the computer, you know, it takes a long time to develop the program, and then you start the program, hit the return, and it already is done. Okay. Unfortunately, that's not the case here. You know, many, many a time, you would actually hit the return, go have several cups of coffee, and it'll still be running. And, you know, and that's basically what your point is. So to say that a search space is huge, or that the search space has as many, has more nodes in it, more states in it than there are atoms in the universe, doesn't really seem to capture people's imagination as much as on a silly tile puzzle, I started my state-of-the-art machine and went to sleep and came back and still it's running. Okay, then you have a more of a sort of a visceral understanding of the fact that computation can be hard. And in fact, the polynomial problems that you have solved all your life are even the cases where you had exponential problems, but the problem size is small enough that you get done in a couple of seconds. Those days are over, at least in this class. You know, you want, if the 922 is the deadline, I hope that you have your program working like a week before so that you can spend a lot of time playing with it and, you know, analyzing the program. Okay, so that's something that you want to keep in mind. This is probably different for some of you at any rate from the kind of projects you have looked at before. Are there any specific questions on the project? I also said, yes.
Let's do the
22nd
of Friday,
right? It's 22nd of Friday? Why does this happen to me? 922nd is a Friday? Okay, 21st. I changed it. 21st. Yeah, 21st. What I meant was 21st. I can't change it right now. Here is the more important issue. I wanted, you know, I could have gone ahead and made it the week after that. You know, I could actually, for all I care, I could make this the end of the semester, and this is the only thing you do. You pay for the course. You know, the fewer things we have to grade, the better off we are. I think 921 is what I have in mind. I'll change it to 921, so it's the Thursday of that week. Okay, that's going to be the deadline that I'm sticking to right now, and I want you to actually start looking at the project, and you know, every week, every class I'll ask, how are things, and what are do you have any questions, and if you look happy, that means you're doing well, or that you couldn't care less. If you couldn't care less, don't ask me for extensions. Makes no sense. You know, extensions are for people who are actually struggling to complete it, and you know, if only they have extra time, then it might help. So I can guarantee you that I have no interest in having the project one be done with only one person completing the project. Okay, so if in fact it takes a lot more because of the way, this is the first reasonable list project, if people are struggling and if you needed more time, I would extend it. I would extend it, you know, in probably halfway through. But if everybody is doing fine, I won't extend it. Okay? And I'm doing you a favor by doing that, because that increases the number of things we have to grade and I have to set extra projects and all that stuff. You don't see it that way, but you know, 10 years later you will come to thank me. So let's try to see how long it takes for the class, because that's the only way I'll figure out. And if it really is needed, that the entire class is more than half the class is falling apart, then we'll extend it at that time. Okay, so 9:21 is the current aspirational deadline. Okay, that's what we aspire to. And if we get done, then we can have other interesting things to do afterwards. Okay. So just to see that, you know, this is A star in Lisp. In the version that I gave you, and I think that's sort of the nice thing about Lisp. There are not that many languages where you can write where functions are first class objects. And so in this case, actually, all this is saying nodes is the queue, okay? And goal P is a goal test function, which you decide for the problem, you write the goal test function. Remember, that's what I said earlier. So it could be anything. It could be a goal test function for 8 puzzle or, N queens problem or planning, anything. So you just provide it at that time. And then children function is a children generator function, and there is an F value function which just basically calls the H value, adds up G and H, and puts the F there. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is the A star search does not know what's inside this, what's inside this, what's inside this. All it knows is the nodes list contains data structures which these guys know how to manipulate, these guys know how to manipulate, these guys know how to manipulate. Okay, and all it's going to do is sort this nodes list and then keep picking the first node, you know, priority first node. That's all. Okay. What's interesting is the way you think of A star search conceptually is exactly the way this got written here. And think of writing this in, you know, maybe Fortran or C or something. You would wind up noticing the elegance of passing functions around. It's not necessarily going to be the fastest code, but an interesting thing to think about is that a higher level language should make your life easy, not the computer's life easy. Okay, and you should, in fact, one way of thinking about whether or not a language is a flexible language is how easy it is to write inoptimal programs in that language. And I'm asking you to think in the opposite way. I mean, you're always thinking in terms of how easy is it to write optimal programs. It turns out that, you know, some program in many languages, the support that's given is so minimal that even if you are going to just start manipulating, you know, small lists or something, you have to write your code anyway. And if you're writing the code anyway, you may as well write it from scratch and try to, you know, optimize the heck out of it from the beginning. Okay. In a rapid prototyping language of the kind Lisp is, you could go ahead and write a program first and see if it works or not. And there is an implicit promise that you will, once it works, you'll come back and optimize it, which nobody keeps. Because of which, people tend to think that higher level languages such as Lisp are inoptimal, in the sense they lead to inefficient programming. That's not the way it is. It's like there are two-part promise that goes on in any higher level language. Let me get rapid prototyping, you know, and see if my idea works or not before I spend a huge amount of time finding all the optimal detail, all the details, optimizing all the details. And if it does work, then I will go ahead and improve. But once it works, none of us actually go ahead and improve. So in some sense, C programming wins because it forces you to actually think of optimality from the day one. Okay. So that's the overall, the higher level differences between the languages. But I still like the fact, I mean, I think, you know, you, as long as you're using this language for this course, you may as well get used to it. One other thing that I hope is, I don't necessarily see a whole bunch of you using Lisp right after this class in every random job you take. However, it's nice to see it's nice to see heaven so that you start missing it. And then you can ask, and you can ask your boss for it. Okay. If you don't know what you're missing, you're just going to think that assembly language is darn good. You know, that's the only thing you've seen. Okay, so part of the idea is to get used to what a higher level programming language affords you. And this is one. There are many other higher level programming languages. And you know, you should get one and get used to it so that you can start missing it. You know, and remember that change comes from frustration. Okay, so here, as all this is saying is, if this queue is null, the queue is, you know, put as a list. If it is null, then that means there's nothing to expand. The queue is empty and you haven't ended, so the search failed. So you just return nil, saying I failed. Okay. If not, what do you do? You pick the first node from the queue, from the nodes list. So that's just first, or car, and then you apply the golp function to that guy. And the way you do it is funcall golp to that. And funcall essentially, one thing that you have to understand in terms of list is in common list, every symbol has a value slot and a function slot, function value slot. A value slot and a function value slot in common list. It's important to understand. And so in general, when you evaluate a symbol, you take the number, you take whatever is in the value slot. In cases like funcall, it's not actually looking, whereas if the symbol comes, in the function place, that is, if you have an expression where some name car is there, okay, car 1, 2, 3. In this case, car may not have any value at all, but it has a function value associated with it. One twisty little thing that you can try when you go home is do the following thing. Set Q car equal to coulda. That means, so basically what you're doing in this case is, I mean, this is not the way you should write programs, but this is just so that you understand what's going on. So car is a symbol. Normally, unless you set a value to car, its value slot is unbounded. It has nothing in it. But it has a function slot, which has a function body, which essentially takes a list and gives the first element of that list. Okay, but what I'm doing by doing this set queue car to be cooder is in this place, so this is function car, and here I'm putting CDR's body. Cooder is the rest body. Okay, so now you can have fun saying car 1, 2, 3, it'll still give you 1, but if you do fun call car 1, 2, 3, you'll get 2, 3 the list. And once you do this, you'll know that there are these two differences. Okay, because you're taking the, you know, funcall takes the value of car and uses it as a function. Yes. Okay, anyway, so that's what we're doing here. Funcall, golp, you're applying goal test to the first of the nodes. If the goal test returns true, and another interesting thing, another important thing you have to understand in Lisp, I guess all of you know, is the nil and non-nil. Okay, anything non-nil is considered true. Okay, what happened? If it returns anything other than nil, then you essentially, that means that node is a goal node. So you basically pick that and return it as the answer from the search. Now remember that node has all the information for the rest of the thing. For example, you can then start from the node, follow the pointers to find the path and print it out if you need to. Okay, if that's not the case, then you will fall here in the cond. And so for everything else, if you fall through these two, then you call A star recursively. And what are you doing in calling it recursively? When you're calling A star again, you will have the same goal function, the same children function, the same F value function. And what you're doing then is you're going to call children function on the node so that the node gets expanded. And the assumption is children function goes inside the node, looks at the state of the node, expands it to multiple world states. For each world state, puts a node around it and sends the list of nodes back to you. Not only does it put a node, it also puts for each of those nodes, it puts the parent pointer and sends that list of nodes to you. That's the only API that you're expecting from this guy. Okay? And then, so you have a list of new children that need to be added to the old children, which is the rest of nodes, and the new nodes which have to be added to the old nodes, which is the rest of nodes, and then you need to sort the whole thing again. Now, in fact, here I'm doing sort, you can do merge sort. I'm actually writing it in just the fastest way possible, fastest way for me, but it's not the fastest program necessarily, okay? And then, you know, sort is actually there in Lisp, and it's a built-in function, and it can take, you know, sort using what? You know, increasing or decreasing? I'm saying less than as the test, so that the lowest value f will come to the top. Now, the other question is, what is less than what? So nodes are structures. How do you compare two nodes? You take the key value. The key is basically f value function. That's all I'm saying, okay? And then you continue. So this is a star search. And what I'm asking in the rest of the program is to sort of improve a bunch of things. So for example, actually I also provided children generator function for part of the children generator function for the 8 puzzle. And I'm asking you to complete the rest. And I'm asking you also, when you are done, not only should you print, you should just actually print the path. For that, you have to, you know, take the node that comes out and, you know, follow the path upwards and then print it downwards. That's not hard. Things like that. Okay. In the project, there are a bunch of extra credit portions which you are welcome to try, you know, if you are done with the easier part. And there's a whole philosophy for extra credit here. I'll keep giving these for the project, and you don't have to do it. It does not really, really affect your grade. It only improves the grade of those people who actually do it. But it does it in such a way that it doesn't worsen your grade. And I have worked this all out, and I'll explain to you one day for an entire lecture how this works. But for now, believe me. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
So you're saying making improvements, right? Everybody's program will basically have a different improvement value.
No. You have to look at the rest of the. You have to look at the entire thing. When I said improvement, it's just a generic improvement. I'm extending the code. Okay. There are specific extensions that I asked all of you to do. It's a functional extensions. It's not just optimization. Okay. You have to read end to end, and then the faster you start reading, the more your questions are going to come earlier rather than later, and the better off you are. Okay. Any other questions on that? Okay. This is a, you know, the project zero is just to get you started. This one is actually you're going to analyze the results. You're going to start looking at how search algorithms. For example, this one also asks you to look at whether, in fact, Manhattan distance is faster. Does it do better than misplaced tiles distance? We talked about it in the class, yes.
Yeah, going back to that, when you call something called guard or function
guard is called
the return
of this. No. All I'm saying, the return of this. Essentially says go to car, which is a symbol, okay, get its value, whatever is the value for car, because I, you know, played around with it, now its car value is actually a function, it's CUDA. So then take that function, apply it to this as the argument.
Okay. So what would be the function
value? You're not changing this, you're only manipulating this. The function value sort of car will continue to be whatever it was before. And the value slot of car would continue to be whatever it was before. You're not changing those. Okay. You guys have to understand, I mean, if you have never thought about how Lisp interpreter works, you should read some description about the, you know, the Lisp interpreter. You know, the general theory of Lisp interpreter. All the time, interpreter is waiting to evaluate. And I have a slide, I can put it up, basically showing how an evaluation works. You need to understand that there should not be any magic to that. Okay, you're always trying to evaluate. If it's an S expression, you assume that the first guy is the name of a function, and the others are all things that give you value. So you evaluate all of them. You apply this function to those guys. That's the normal idea. And if you, sometimes you can make evaluator do special things to say don't evaluate. To say don't evaluate, you say you put a quote. Okay, that's a special form. Okay, but you should definitely understand the default behavior of an interpreter to feel at home with Lisp. If you are ever thinking, I mean, I remember Lisp is the worst thing to do with Lisp is try to, I mean, any programming language, especially Lisp, is to try to understand Lisp and, you know, pencil and paper without actually interpreter in front of you. I mean, the first time when I was an undergraduate, I would not go into actual details as to the year and so on. We had computers then, except we didn't have access to them. And so these guys taught us Lisp by board using the way I'm showing them, you know, put brackets and so on and so forth. And so people just hate the idea of counting the brackets and wondering continually, should I put a quote or not put a quote? If you ever, in your time with Lisp, start having a question as to whether you should put a quote or not put a quote, just stop doing whatever you're doing. Go back to the page one of Lisp manual. Understand how Lisp works, okay? If you ever start having questions as to whether I should put a quote or not quote, you haven't understood how Lisp works. That's the sure sign of not understanding Lisp, okay? And I can tell you this, you know, one of the advantages of having done all the problems, I mean, going through all the problems myself is I get to be a good teacher, you know. I have done all this. I mean, I have looked at one point in my time, I guess, I looked at Lisp wondering, should I put a quote here or not? So it's like you make the whole thing and start randomly putting quotes. That's the worst way, and that basically means you didn't understand what actually happens to the interpreter. Okay. So I said several times last class that I'll say something about an actual optimality proof, at least a different version of optimality proof. This is a contrapositive proof for both A-star search, but let's do that starting with uniform cost search, and then we'll just extend it to uniform to A-star search. Okay. See, these proofs normally go this way, and it's worth understanding them. I mean, I won't, you know, you can read this stuff yourself, but let me look at this picture, basically. So these proofs go in the following ways. You're trying to prove that when the search stops and returns a solution, it's going to be optimal. So one way you can prove it is by assuming the opposite and showing a contradiction. That's proof by contradiction. Okay? So suppose in this problem, so I started with node N0, I mean in this scenario, I started with node N0, and I ended, by the way, I'm looking at this case on uniform search. I'm going to reprove the optimality of uniform search and then extend it to A star search. Okay? So I ended with N, but my search returned N as the optimal node. As my search said, that's the optimal node. And the question is, you know, to prove that this will always be an optimal node, let me assume the opposite. Let me assume that it's not the optimal node. There is some other node which is actually optimal. Okay? So let's assume that N dash is that node. Okay? So if N dash is the optimal node and you're doing uniform cost search, then clearly you have a crisp statement which basically says G of N dash is less than G of N. That means the path cost from N0 to N dash, the optimal path cost from N0 to N dash is shorter than the path cost from N0 to N. That's the assumption. If in fact the search, you know, is wrong, then this would be true. Now, having said that, now let me see if I can show an inconsistency. Okay, the way we'll go about that is, now what went wrong? You know, N got picked up. You know, so at some point of time, N was picked up by the search node, I mean, by the search strategy, uniform search, and it applied goal test to it. Goal test said, yeah, you're a goal. And so it says, okay, I stop. Okay, now, at the time N was picked up, if N dash was on the queue, it couldn't have been picked up, right? Because after all, I mean, you know, unless your program doesn't understand the idea of less than, if we already are saying N dash is better than N, and that means G of N dash is less than G of N, then if N dash was present on the queue of possibilities, at the time N was picked, then N shouldn't have been picked at all. There's no way it could have been picked unless your sorting algorithm is screwed up. Okay? So we are not talking about implementation. So we assume that the only reason that happened, the only possible reason that could have happened is that either N dash, so if N dash was present on the queue, then it couldn't have been picked up. Or rather, if it's picked up, that means the G N dash now is in fact greater than or equal to G of N, which is directly contradicting our assumption. So it will right away be done. The contradiction comes right away if in fact N dash was present. If N dash was not present on the queue, okay, it's not yet come on to the queue, could I still show a contradiction? Basically, it's clear that if N dash is not present on the queue, then some ancestor of N dash must have been present on the queue. Okay, so let's call that ancestor of N dash, which happened to be present when N was picked for expansion, N double dash. Just call that, you know, just an existential variable. Now, you know that if this guy got picked up in favor of, I mean, you know, if this guy got picked up rather than this guy, that must be because G of N is less than G of N double dash. Okay, which means the cost of coming to N double dash is already more than cost of coming to N. Now, how can that be that if you continue from N double dash and go further more, the cost can only increase? The cost will increase as long as it is the case that the edge costs are positive. Okay, so if the edge costs are positive, then it must be the case that the G of N dash is greater than or equal to G of N double dash, which creates the contradiction with our original assumption. So another way of understanding it is that the path cost has to keep increasing, and if you are already, if this path is already bad compared to this path, it can't get any better. Notice that I did not use, in this proof, I did not require that the, I did not require that the edge costs have to be non-zero. I only said they have to be non-negative. So optimality is guaranteed as long as edge costs are non-negative. To get completeness, you need non-zero also. Okay? So optimality says if you did terminate. So if you did terminate, then it must be the case that you are optimal. To get completeness, there should be non, you know, every edge should be non-zero. Okay? So that's the basic idea for the proof here. Understood? Okay? So the basic, again, the intuition here is a path cost to N double dash, to come to N double dash, cannot be more than the cost to go through N double dash to N dash. Okay? Now the question is, can I make the same proof work for A star search too? Can I make the same argument work for A star search too? Now what are the differences between uniform search and A star search? The important difference is instead of using H, you're using, I mean, instead of using G, you're using F. Instead of using G, you're using F. Okay? So when N was picked up for expansion, that was because N had the lowest F value among all the nodes in the search queue. Among all the nodes in the search queue. Okay? And if N dash was present at that time, then there is a direct contradiction because F of N dash is equal to G of N dash, F of N is equal to G of N, and you're basically requiring that one is less than the other, at the same time requiring that it's also greater than that. Okay, so there's a direct contradiction. Once again, the interesting case would be, what if at the time N was picked, this guy was not present, but one of its ancestors were present? When the ancestor was present, the important point is that you know that, you know the cost of G, so the F of N double dash is G of N double dash plus H of N double dash. H is the estimate of going from here to here. And we did say that if H is admissible, we, you know, this is, the proof is only for admissible heuristics. If H is admissible, then this estimate is definitely less than or equal to the true cost of going from N double dash to N dash. Okay? So what in essence I'm saying is this guy got ticked because the lower bound estimate of the best path going through n double dash is already worse than the bird I have in hand. The lower bound estimate of the best path that can go through n double dash is already worse than what I have in hand. So why bother expanding this anymore? That's it. That's your proof. Okay? So if you know, this sort of argument can also be used to do other things, such as if the heuristic is not exactly admissible, but it when it overestimates, it only overestimates by at most an epsilon. Okay? Then you can show that you would be only an epsilon distance away from the true optimum. This exact proof can be repeated with that. Should not be hard, and you know, you'll be made to do that on the homework probably. Okay. Let me do this. Since we are talking about heuristics, this is just to kind of get all of you to get your bearing straight on heuristic function. Okay. Here is an H star heuristic function. I'm assuming that the Y value here is the actual H value, and the x-axis is the nodes. I just wrote the nodes down, N1, N2, it's all the way down. Okay? So that's the H star function. First question, if this is the H star function, would you even bother solving this problem? I didn't tell you anything about the problem, other than the fact that it's the H star function. Is H star ever zero in this picture? No. If it's not zero, that means there's no goal node. Okay? So presumably every admissible heuristic must be zero at the goal. Okay? And the only reason it's not zero, if I didn't show that it's zero, that means there's no goal node. You should assume that's the case. Okay? In general, to show a problem which also have goal nodes in these kinds of pictures, I would have to wind up having something which comes, goes to zero, and again goes back up. That means at least there it is, goal node. Remember that this doesn't tell you too much about the search space topology. All I'm saying essentially is I just took a permutation of nodes N1 up to N infinity, okay? And I'm just writing the values for them. Okay, that's the thing. So now I want to ask a couple of questions. So here is H1, admissible, not admissible? Quick. Admissible, not admissible? What? Admissible, okay? H5, non-admissible. H4, no. Okay, because it winds up kind of poking its head here. Anybody who pokes their head out of the red one, red is the H star, you know, they get hit, they're no longer admissible. Okay? H2, is that admissible or not admissible? Admissible. If you can use either H2 or H1, which would you rather use? H2 or H1, which one would you rather use? H2, because you are much closer to the red one. So H2 is more informed than H1. Okay, this picture, if you remember this picture, then you will kind of internalize the point that admissibility, informedness are for all properties. That means if there exists an N where H1 is more than H star, then it's no longer admissible. Okay, so proving inadmissibility is by counterexample. Proving admissibility is by a normal proof, like in the way of mathematics. Okay. Here is another guy. I forgot his name. One more guy. I just made up one more guy. Let's see. Now, in this case, so I guess I have a name which can't come in the next time. So there is a heuristic here. There is a heuristic here. Is one more informed than the other? Suppose I gave you both. You could call both of them for the same cost. Could you do search better than just calling one of them? Yes, what? What do you do? Yeah, who said yeah? Okay, what do you do?
Call them both for each node and just choose whatever's higher.
Exactly, take the max. Here is a way of generating informed heuristics, more informed heuristics. So if you have a bunch of losers, As long as one loser is not dominating the other loser, you actually have, you can do better than any one of them by taking max of them, right? So in particular, if you take the max, that's the max of H2, H3, which is basically an envelope on those two, and that's more informed than either one of them. That's more informed than either one of them, right? Okay, so come back to this picture whenever you are in question about informedness and admissibility. Now, I made a huge deal about informedness, right? Let me ask you the following question. Suppose I have a space, okay, where H star is like this. Let's assume that I only showed you part of it. There is some place where it actually does touch the goal. So it does become zero. So there is a goal, okay? So H star is like this. I'll give you two heuristics, H1 and H2. Okay, H1, H2. Which is more informed according to the definition of informedness? Which do you think is likely to do well in practice? I mean, there's a reason why this thing looks like this, because I took this, copied it and pushed it down on the PowerPoint. Okay, so just use your intuition. What do you think is better for this problem? Okay. And yet, informedness seems to say that H1 should be better. What gives? Well, what gives is this. In fact, when you actually do project 1, you would find that there may be problems where Manhattan distance winds up expanding more nodes than the misplaced style heuristic. And at which point many people drop out saying, you know, this course makes no sense because, you know, he said it's more informed and yet it's not. Okay. Now what is interesting is the following. An informed versus non-informed heuristic. The only thing you can say is a less informed heuristic will expand every interior node that the more informed heuristic would expand, okay, in the following sense. So think of the nodes in terms of their F values, okay, in terms of their true F values. You know that you will never expand a node whose F value is more than F star, where F star equal to G star is equal to the F value of the optimal goal node. You clearly know that you would not expand any nodes whose F value is more than F star. Any node which got expanded whose F value is less than F star is called an interior node. And any node which got expanded whose F value is equal to F star is called a fringe node in this view. Okay? An informed heuristic is guaranteed to expand, non-informed heuristic is guaranteed to expand every fringe node that the informed heuristic expands. But among the fringe nodes itself, you cannot give any guarantee. Now, if it turns out that your search space is such that everybody has the same F value, and they're all sitting on the fringe, it could happen either because of the search space or because your heuristic thinks everybody is as good as everybody else. Okay? In such cases, essentially, you'll wind up doing all your expansions at the F star level. And so that winds up, in that case, so in this case, it can still be possible that H1 winds up doing more expansions than H2, except it's expanding them but F equal to F star level. Okay? Another interesting thing is that this also shows essentially that informedness is a bogus property. You know, it's easy to define, but it's not as useful. Really, you want the heuristic to be able to differentiate between good and bad nodes. Just the same way H star differentiates between good and bad nodes. And clearly H2 differentiates exactly the way H star differentiates, except like a delta offset. Okay, so it would be actually reasonable to talk about characterizations of heuristics in terms of the differentiation they make between nodes of the search state. And there is some work in that. It's just we don't do it because it's not as easy to do. and so much easier to remember informed nest description. And it does work for the interior nodes, the comparison does hold. Okay. So again, as I said, nevertheless, informedness of a heuristic is a reasonable qualitative measure. You know, I had to make this example to really easily show that something which is theoretically more informed, you can also see is a dumb idea. Yes? That's what I'm saying. So you have to look at this paper, CARP 2000, which talks about, so in some sense, the goodness of the heuristic depends upon whether it differentiates between good and bad nodes. Okay, so this sort of, I don't know whether it's connected or not, but I have this anecdote anyway. So if you are applying for jobs and you got a reference letter from Einstein, recommendation letter from Einstein, would you think you should get a job or not? Einstein is giving the reference letter, right? You would think you should get the job. At the turn of the century, when Einstein was in the business of writing reference letters, all physics departments would regularly throw his reference letter out. Why? Because he's such a nice guy. You ask him, he'll say yes. And he'll say he is or she is the greatest thing since sliced bread for everybody. And so he wouldn't differentiate really between, you know, the losers and non-losers of the world because he was too nice. So even though Einstein, you know, I mean, so in that particular case, because he wasn't differentiating between people, physics departments would just throw away his reference letter. So only people who don't know this will go and ask Einstein for reference letters and expect, you know, get really mad that nobody hired them, you know. So the important thing that story brings up is differentiation is important. It's not enough to just know what the goal is. It is also important to know what is not a goal and avoid going in the wrong direction. Okay. And so you can characterize the differentiability of a heuristic in terms of, for example, how many different values does it give to various nodes. A heuristic which has 0 and 1 value, so it's a binary value, it's either 0 or 1, is clearly not going to be as good as a heuristic which is continuous values between 0 and 1. It's again a syntactic restriction, syntactic point. Okay? So you could consider doing that. So we talked about, so are there any, yes sir? Say it loud, I can't hear you. I have no clue. I didn't know how I generated them. For me, generating involves just drawing those pictures, which was the same, you know. But really, you need to know about the domain to see. You can spend a huge amount of time and generate useless heuristics. So the cost of generating a heuristic is depends upon how much of an abstraction was involved. Okay, so I really can't answer that with that picture there because I was just, as far as I was concerned, I just put those lines there. But it's a good point. Okay. The other interesting thing, having made this whole thing about informedness, admissibility, etc., is you'll see that in practice, and you'll see that pretty much starting next week or beginning at the end of today's class, that when we start talking about planning, that many times for large-scale search problems, people actually don't go out of their way to find admissible heuristics. Because if the difference between admissible and an inadmissible heuristic is getting done in a day versus getting done in maybe a year, you say, heck with it, I would live with the inoptimal heuristic. And this also brings up the difference between like a hacker and a programmer, a hacker and a computer scientist. Both of them ultimately would probably do the thing that is needed to solve the problem, okay? But computer scientists will at least feel guilty if they are doing theoretically the wrong thing. It's important to know, again, it's important to know what is optimality before you blithely give it up. Okay, it's important to know that what you are missing. Okay, so it's not necessarily the case that people actually always use admissibility, but you have a clear understanding now of when you can be assured of optimality if you so care to exercise your option. Okay, and we'll see later on that in fact finding admissible heuristics sometimes is harder than finding inadmissible heuristics, and so many a time people just go with inadmissible heuristics and take the hit. Okay. We talked about IDA star. By the way, that particular slide, I just couldn't avoid discussing it, but I did put an advance there. It's really somewhat more, slightly more out of the scope than some of the other things I talked about here. IDA star, we talked about it, right, last time? Questions about IDA star? So IDA star essentially does the iterations in terms of the F value rather than the D value. Okay, iterative deepening depth first search does iterations in terms of depth D, and this does it in terms of F. And as I said last time, F can be distinct. Now, in fact, from the point of view of reducing the number of iterations for IDA star, you want your F values to be as few as possible. Agreed? What was I talking about a minute back? To differentiate losers from winners and also differentiate the degree of loserness from the winnerness, you want your F values to be as many as possible, maybe. Pay attention. Okay? And, you know, it may or may not be a major tension in practice, but I think part of understanding different topics is actually seeing the consequences of this, and seeing if there are interesting tensions. And here is one, for example. I just argued that you want to differentiate, you know, sort of in minute fashion, you know, good versus bad nodes, but then if you overdo that, you can get into trouble here. Okay? Now, you have to try IDA star. By the way, one piece of information about IDA star is, how do you know what is the F value for the next iteration? In the depth first thing, first depth is 1, next depth is 2, next depth is 3, next depth is 4. For IDA star, what is the next F value? The answer is, you know current F value, which is a threshold. Whenever you're expanding a node, if any of its children whose F values are more than the threshold would not be part of the current iteration. However, you remember the child who just exceeded the threshold. So the minimum among the guys who are being thrown out. And when you have seen all the guys, then if you keep updating this minimum counter, that would give you the next F value. So who among all the nodes that we just expanded wound up missing the threshold by the least amount? That is the next F value that you should consider. Okay? It's possible that the difference between the worst case versus best case is, oftentimes many guys hopefully would miss the threshold. In the worst case scenario, exactly one guy would be, many guys will miss the threshold by the same least amount. In the worst case scenario, one guy would miss for each threshold. And so you would have to bring him in, and then you have to do an extra iteration. Okay? So that's exactly what is being said here. This is the next largest F value. So you have a threshold, you want to keep track of what is the next largest F value above this threshold. And you update that while you're doing the search. And that's enough. Okay? And then that would become the next iteration threshold, and then you continue. Now, I made it sound as if iterative deepening, all ideas are, greatest things since sliced bread compared to other things. In particular, I said, running out of memory is really, really bad. Okay, but then I may have overdone it, because A star search takes B power D amount of space, which could be for the large B and D values, which could be terabytes of memory. Maybe you don't have it. IDA star and IDDFS take B times D space, which even for reasonably large B and D values would be under like a megabyte, much less than a megabyte. I don't know anybody who has only a megabyte of memory, right? I mean, in fact, it'd be much less. In fact, it's more like 100 kilobytes is what we're talking about. So why should you just go from requiring 20 terabytes to getting by with 1 kilobyte? Why can't I use the rest of my memory and avoid some of the iterations? Makes sense, right? I do have this thing. I paid for it. It's mine. Many of us have couple of gigabytes at least these days. I have 1 gigabyte and my students have a couple of them. So you can, even in main memory size, right? So you can actually use it. So the question would be, what does it take to use all the memory and only start thrashing when the memory only start swapping when the memory starts becoming bigger, memory starts getting filled. So that's this idea. There are a bunch of algorithms which I won't talk about here, one of which is SMA star. I'll give you the general idea behind it so you can sort of figure out the details if you are more interested. What SMA star does is it acts like A star search as long as the size of the search tree that you will wind up searching to find the optimal goal is less than the memory you have, in which case it's just like A star. So when you are about to, so it keeps track of the memory it has taken and it takes the memory threshold. Okay, so suppose you could say you are allowed 10,000 nodes, and so it keeps track of how many nodes in the search tree does it currently have. Okay, and as soon as it reaches 10,000, it knows that it needs to free up space. So it needs to take somebody in the search tree. Remember, for understanding a search algorithm is best done in terms of the search tree, which is the nodes, which is the tree of nodes, starting with the root node, followed by its children nodes, followed by its children nodes, and so on, where each node has some corresponding world state. Okay? So you have to remove a node from the search tree so that somebody else has space. And if you need like 5 guys to come in, you need to remove 5 nodes from the current guy. You do this in computers, right? I mean, you basically, what is it called? Paging. You throw stuff from main memory to disk, okay? And you don't just put the smallest amount in the memory. In fact, you know, all of you know that you can improve the performance of a program by increasing its initial memory requirement. And so, in fact, Internet Explorer, some versions just take all the memory from the beginning itself so that next time around it doesn't need to restart anything. Okay, so you can increase the footprint up front. And then when there are other guys that come in, when you need even more than that, then you start paging in and out. Okay, so that's the same thing you do here except for the nodes. Now, the question is, who do you page out? In all paging strategies, the important question is, who is the loser who is going to be paged out, right? And here, what's the metric for the loserness of a node in search? If it's an A star search, the F value of the node. The node which has the worst possible F value. So you have the prioritized queue. If you want to start making space, make the space. If you're taking node for expansion, you take it from this end. If you want to make space, you start removing guys from this side, because these are the current losers. Now, that's good enough. The question, of course, is what if all these other guys, this heuristic is not a good heuristic, all these other guys actually look like they're winners, but after a while, you'll find that they're all losers. But then the only winner looked like a loser, so you killed him. How do you get the completeness and optimality? There should be a way of re-expanding the guys who you unexpanded. So what you do in this idea, essentially, is whenever you remove a node, remember that, it's a search tree, right? And even if you are dead, and I mean it only figuratively, your parent is still up in the tree. Okay? So this is the worst possible node, kill it, and its F value is 17. Maybe the parent's real F value was 14 when the parent came into being, but now, since this node is getting killed, I'll just go and say, well, this is gone, and this guy's F value now is 17. This is the most useful child this node has that doesn't currently exist in the search tree. Okay? So if ever it turns out that in the prioritized list of nodes, this guy starts looking the most effective one, it will get picked up, it will get re-expanded. Okay, now the important thing was previously, remember, I said originally its F value was 14. But when you actually expanded it, you found that these guys' F values were bigger, so you backed up the F value back. So in fact, even though this says it's 14, really its F value is 17 because the best path that goes through it through one of the non-existent nodes is in fact 70. That's how you bring it back. So then you will re-expand that node. Okay. This winds up being way faster than IDA star, because in cases where IDA star doesn't care that you have 2 gigabytes of memory, it'll just try to keep itself in one corner of your computer. Right? Whereas this guy uses as much of the memory as it can and only starts cleaning when needed. Much smarter idea. Okay, there are other details that you still have to keep track of, but this is enough to figure out that all you're remembering is you're backing up the F value of your most promising dead child. Now, the interesting thing is the following. This can happen recursively. At some point of time, it so happens that you needed even more space, and this guy started looking like the worst guy. So remember, the fringe used to be, previously the fringe used to be like this. And so this node was the worst. Now when this guy is gone, and then some other search happened, the fringe has now become this, and this guy is the worst F value. So he dies. And its parent now remembers F equal to 17. So really, 17 is the best promising descendant you have who is dead. And when you have no other life, there's no other light in the search queue other than these things, you will re-expand this node. Reasonable thing to do. Not hard, right? Pretty intuitive thing to do. Okay, so that's a nice idea called SMS star. Except, you know, it does thrash when you know, computers thrash, right? I mean, like if you, in critical regions, they can spend all their time paging in and out as against doing anything. And, you know, SMS star can also be made to thrash by reducing the memory too little. But it's definitely better asymptotically than IDA star. Okay. Questions on this, all this stuff? So we'll now talk about a different variety of search algorithms called iterative improvement algorithms. And these are also called local search algorithms. Iterative improvement are local search algorithms. And what local search algorithms are doing essentially is, you know, in A star, any search algorithm which has a search tree, from the point for an informal description, think about the opposite of a local search is, you know, non-local or global or systematic. And what we did till now are called systematic search strategies. Okay, and normally the definition of systematic search goes like this. Leave no stone unturned, part one. Part two, don't turn any stone more than once. That's a systematic search. So you have to look at every place, don't leave anything unturned while you're looking for the goal, and don't look at any single place arbitrary number of times. Okay? All systematic search strategies have those properties. Now you would say that IDDFS does turn some stones multiple times. But as long as there's a bound on the number of times you turn the stone, you're okay. Okay? IDDFS still only turns a stone multiple times, but the multiple is a finite number of times. It will never keep looking at the same node or expanding the same node many, 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 many times without bound. So that's the notion of systematic search. So in a way, systematic searches look at the entire search space. So they're actually good at finding a goal if in fact goal exists. Okay? Local search is the opposite of systematic search, which basically says, I really don't care about looking at the entire search space. I will look around the neighborhood of where I am and try to do the most seemingly more optimal thing from within my neighborhood. Okay? Now, in general, the word iterative improvement comes because instead of looking for a path from the initial node to the goal node, in many problems, you really don't care about the path. It's enough if I show you the goal node. You will know what the path is. You know, let me give you an example. So here is an example called the N Queens problem, where the problem is to put, it's an example of an assignment problem. The problem here is to place N queens on an N by N chessboard such that no pair of queens are going to be conflicting using the rules of chess. You know that queens can go diagonally or up and horizontal. Okay. So you want to put N queens on an N by N chessboard such that no pair of queens are going to be conflicting. And you can do it for eight queens, million queens, you know, 2 million queens, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Now, in this kind of a problem, you don't need the path. You know, the originally I'll give you some configuration, and I'll tell you here is the correct configuration. And if you can look at the correct configuration, you see, yeah, it is correct because there is no pair that is conflicting. You're happy. Okay. And do you want me to, do you then care as to how I went from there to here? No. I got the solution. So if I just show you the solution, that's enough. You don't need the path to come to the solution. Okay. Local search algorithms are particularly good when, in fact, all you want is the solution, not the path to the solution. Okay. So iteratively improve a candidate solution, which could have been a solution, but it's not. You keep tweaking it until it becomes a solution. This is the way local search works. It's an iterative improvement algorithm. Okay. You know, N queens essentially is an example of a problem called an assignment problem, and all assignment problems can be solved in an iterative way. Okay. Traveling salesperson, another example, you know. That too, if I do give you the optimal circuit, you don't really care how I found it. Okay. Now, what about 8 puzzles? Suppose I show you, so I'll keep a completed puzzle in my, you know, right hand pocket. Whenever you show me, you know, a configuration, I'll show you this. Are you happy? You are not, obviously, because it's not enough to show that there's a goal. You need to show the path. Now, it turns out that you can do local search on 8 puzzle too. All you need to do is you need to start including the path information into the state. If you start including the path information into the state, then it can be made into an iterative improvement algorithm too. But some problems are more naturally thought of as path-oriented problems. Some are more naturally thought of as iterative configuration problems. And, you know, local search algorithms are much better suited for the iterative improvement. Okay. So now, in those kind of cases, what do we want to do? What I want to do, essentially, is I will start with my current candidate solution, whatever it is that you gave me. So in the N queens case, I'll just put randomly the N queens on the board. That's my initial place. And then, so here is my current candidate solution, and I'll ask my goal test function, is it a solution? Okay? I'll ask my goal test function, is it a solution? And if it says yes, you just are a lucky kid. You know, you randomly pick something and it's a goal and you go home. If not, then you need to ask yourself, what are all the differences between me and the goal? You need to have some notion of the differences between you and the goal. And in particular, what you really need is, if this is not the goal node already, then think of a neighborhood for this. Think of a neighborhood, basically a finite set of additional configurations that you can generate from this configuration, and you would see which of them is the most promising with respect to some goodness function. Now, the goodness function sort of looks like heuristic function that we discussed earlier, but it has some differences. But, you know, think of it as, for now at least, think of it as something which tells you how close to goal you are. Okay? And so the goodness function will basically be applied to the neighborhood, and you pick the neighbor that is the most promising, and you now say, this is my current solution. And you forget that you used to be in another place. That's very important, because in a In a systematic search, when you go from one node to another node, you keep these pointers around. In local search, now that I'm here, I forget. I'm amnesiac, completely forgotten how you got here. And then I'll again look at my neighborhood around this and find the best neighbor and try to commit to that. The beauty of this particular way of doing search is it takes constant space. There's no search tree. Okay? And if you have a goodness function which is sort of connected to the topology of the search space, then you can make local moves that somehow are connected to going towards the goal. And these kinds of algorithms are actually called, very aptly, hill climbing algorithms. Why are they called hill climbing algorithms? Because if you don't know where is the peak of the mountain that you're trying to reach, and it's foggy, and your glasses have just fallen down, and I don't know why you are on the mountain, then you are in this place. You need to decide which direction to take a step. You have, you know, no GPS, no map, all that stuff. Okay, so you have, so all you can do is you can take a step in all possible directions, maybe four or five directions, whatever you feel like, and then see, you know, in each step, in each direction, which direction seems to have increased your altitude the most. Now, altitude then becomes the goodness function. Okay, because you've decided that the goal has the highest altitude, so any neighbor which seems to increase your altitude is sort of on the way to the peak. And so you take a step in that and then repeat this process. And to the extent, you know, if you are in a nice cinder cone kind of a, you know, mountain or a cinder cone itself, you know what cinder cones are, like this pyramid sort of a thing, it works perfectly. Because when you go up to the higher guy, there is no chance that you will ever come down to the lower guy, because coming back would be reducing your height, so you will never come back. Furthermore, the entire search space in the cinder cone is made in such a way that wherever you are, you fall towards the, in terms of height, you fall towards the summit. So hill climbing works perfectly for certain configurations. Okay, now what would hill climbing do, for example, in the eight queens kind of a problem? In the eight queens kind of a problem, how do I define goodness? You know, in the climbing cinder cones and climbing Everest, it's altitude. I understand, that's a good analogy. But what is the goodness function for eight queens problem? The goodness function for eight queens problem could be the number of pairwise conflicts in the current configuration. It would become equal to zero if you are in the goal. If I have two neighbors, one has 15 conflicts left, one has only three conflicts left, I'll take the three guys. That's the goodness function. Okay? And furthermore, actually, a classic hill climbing would also say, if I am at a two, so if I'm currently at a two conflict configuration, and my best neighbor is a three conflict configuration, I'll say to heck with the rest of the problem, I'll just stay here. Because I have reached some sort of a nirvana in terms of, a local nirvana in terms of my goodness function. Now, why doesn't that happen in the cinder cone? Because you cannot reach local nirvana in terms of altitude on the cinder cone until you reach the only summit that is there. Which also means that if you now have foothills on the way to the top, you could have the same problem. Furthermore, if I'm standing here and I'm trying to get on top of Mount Everest, which direction should I go? Tell me. This way, this way, this way, this way. I have no clue, of course. What? Jump from here to where? I know you'd like me to jump because the class is over, but the point is, right now, there is no height differential here. Okay, so I can't actually, there is nothing guiding me. Okay, so the general idea is hill climbing is great when the topology, when the, if you consider, let's say, the search space and the goodness function on the search space. If the goodness function has unimodal behavior, that means it becomes maximum in only one place and nowhere else, or minimum in only one place and nowhere else, hill climbings are great. Okay, they will start having all sorts of troubles if you have the topology of the goodness function is like this, and so the landscape of the current states, the states and the goodness function winds up being like this. So here you have one maximum here, one maximum here, one maximum here, but this is not even a good looking maximum because it's like flat. And then there is a shoulder here, okay, and then you can also have a long part which has no change in the altitude. In all those cases, hill climbing dies because it doesn't, not dies, it doesn't know which direction to go. So it's sort of meandering, sort of what we do in life, but you know, you have no direction. And so the question then is, how do we keep the good things about hill climbing, which seems to have this constant space, okay, and also it's able to, another thing that actually is not obvious up front when you're thinking of hill climbing is, if you are solving the hill climbing, if you're solving the same problem by hill climbing that your friend is solving using A star search. Okay, suppose you come to a point where you're in a particular state S, right, and the neighbor of the state S is really, really good looking. Good looking in the goodness function sense, not, you know, other things. And you'd like to go there. Your friend also would like to go there. But then it could be that, so here is S dash, and you can just, you know, I mean, here is S one, I mean, S dash, and here is S. So if it's a neighbor, you can go. Nobody stops you. Your friend could be unlucky and can have the A star, the search tree is in such a way that this is in one subtree and this winds up being in another subtree. So the only way he would be able to go in things like depth first search strategy in particular is to go up and come down. So in a way, what happens in the systematic search is your freedom to meander around is reduced. That's how you get the guarantee that you would exhaust the whole space. Okay? In hill climbing, your freedoms are not restricted at all. You have infinite freedoms, but then nobody is looking after whether you're going in cycles until, you know, forever. Okay? But this ability to follow the landscape, goodness function landscape, and reach, go directly towards, you know, promising directions, is great if you are in that situation. So what I would like to see is, can I make hill climbing functions not get stuck in local minima? In particular, when you are in this kind of a scenario, what happens is hill climbing can get stuck here and say that is the goal. It's not, but that's the best I can do. And if it's in some of these kinds of places, it can just keep meandering around without going anywhere. Okay, so there are all sorts of nice names for all these problems which come from the mountaineering, you know, ridges, shoulders, plateaus, you know. And a ridge is one where, in essence, it's like a Manhattan distance, a Manhattan navigation in elevation. So you can't go like this. You have to go like this and like this. And when you're going like this, your altitude isn't increasing. So you won't do it. And so you're stuck on the ridge. Okay? So all these normal problems exist for hill climbing. So the question is, what can you do to make it complete? What you can do are a bunch of things. You can actually random restart hill climbing. What you can do is, after a while of trying to reach the top, you look at your clock and say, you know, it's been a long time. I've been wintering around. Let me just transport myself to the random other place and restart again. That's random restart. Now, it's hard to do on Everest because you can't randomly transport yourself to the Tibet side if you're on the Nepal side. You have to have a visa, separate one. But if you are in an 8 queens or an N queens puzzle, right, what's random? What it means is you just randomly reshuffle the queens on the board and you have a new random state and restart from there again. And you'll be lucky this time, hopefully. Probabilistically speaking, you might be lucky. Okay, that's one idea. The other idea is, one of the problems that hill climbing gets stuck in is its essential greediness. It always tries to go towards the direction that increases its elevation, which is good if you are going up cinder cones, but not good if you're going up Mount Whitney. which is the tallest peak in the continental North America, in the our part, I mean not Mount McKinley, continental United States. Okay, and you know, those of you who know anything about Mount Whitney, you can barely see the peak of Mount Whitney because it's like in the middle of every other peak, which is exactly the same size, more or less. Okay, so it's not good to, so sometimes you have to go in directions that look locally inoptimal to reach the global optimum. So you have to reduce your greediness. What do? You essentially say, with probability P, I will take my most promising neighbor. With probability 1 minus P, I will take any of my neighbors. Not least promising. I mean, you don't have to be particularly bad either. Okay. So with probability P, you do the greedy thing. 1 minus P, you hedge your bets and take one of the other neighbors. Any of the neighbors, randomly choose. Okay. If you do this, you can again show that probabilistically you have a higher chance of reaching, asymptotically you can reach the global maximum. Okay, unless P equal to 1, which case it's actual hill climbing, because it's only going the optimal direction, it's only going in the locally optimal direction. A version of this P and 1 minus P idea is something called simulated annealing, which many of you may have heard of. What that says is, let us dynamically change this P parameter. In the beginning of the search, let P be very small. And so you're likely to try random directions in the beginning of the search. But as the search has progressed, after about 15, 16 hours, you increase the P value. So that means you reduce the chance that you will try random moves. Okay? This winds up removing the issue that the original one has, which is how do you set the P? If you set it too low, you can take forever. Okay? So here you start with low, but then you keep increasing the P value such that you're doing the greedy thing more probably doing the greedy thing towards the end of the search. The reason it's called simulated annealing is worth understanding. It's a beautiful analogy, and then you get to go home after that. The idea is, if you are trying to, I mean, this comes from physics community, if you're trying to crystallize, if you're trying to grow crystals, okay, so what can you do? You can, you know, take an irregular solid, which can have a crystalline form, melt it until it becomes liquidy, and then slowly, and then cool it down, and hope that it becomes crystal. Now, crystal is just one of the forms that it can take. Now, what's the good thing about crystals? Good thing about crystals, if you remember anything from the old times, is crystals have the lowest internal energy. Those configurations have the lowest internal energy. So, in some sense, this in the energy space, crystalline configuration is a global minimum. And so, if you can reach that, you get good crystals. The question is, how do you reach that? What basically you say is, start at a very high temperature and slowly reduce the temperature. And in particular, the rate of reduction of the temperature is high in the beginning and low towards the end. Okay? And that essentially is very similar to starting with a low probability of doing the greedy thing and increasing the probability of doing the greedy thing, but the rate of change also increases. And another way to remember this is, suppose I have a metal plate which has troughs in it. Okay, so, and I have a bunch of metal balls. Okay, now I want to get all the balls into the deepest trough, because that's the global minimum. So one idea is, I put all these balls in the plate, assume that the plate has some flat part also. So you put them in some flat part, hold this plate and start shaking it. Okay? In the beginning, shake it quite vigorously. And then as time goes on, shake it much less vigorously. And if you shake it vigorously, the probability that what you're doing is the probability that something which is in the shallow trough will come out of the trough is higher. So in the beginning, you want to dislodge them such that they will tend to go towards the global minimum. And as the time goes on, you reduce the shaking. Again, that's exactly the kind of thing that you're doing in the simulated annealing. But the point to understand is that all three of them are trying to do the exact same thing, which is reduce the essential greediness of the hill climbing algorithm. The simplest one to implement is the top one. And let me just say that you can solve million queen problems. I don't know why you would want to solve it. You don't have a million by million board, but you can solve million queen problems in under minutes as of 5 years back, so it's under seconds now, if you do hill climbing in with that same goodness function I gave you in terms of conflict with random restart. So that's how powerful the idea is. Okay, and to really realize how powerful the idea is, go home and try to solve the eight queens problem yourself by actually placing them and see how long it will take. Okay, we'll come back next time and start doing planning.